afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. You know, we like to say here that human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and so inevitably they will function in such a way that they project some kind of ultimate concern, some kind of overarching understanding of life that may be very well thought out and very conscious, or maybe something that's just picked up like measles from the surrounding social atmosphere. And we also know that we've seen more and more people leaving organized religion. We've seen the rise of the unaffiliated, the so-called nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And my guest, David Zoll, has pointed out that people may be leaving organized religion, but the marketplace in replacement religion is booming. He's the author of Seculosity. A great phrase. Seculosity, how career, parenting, technology, food, politics, and romance became our new religion and what to do about it. David is the founder and director of Mockingbird Ministries, editor-in-chief of the popular Mockingbird website, and co-host of the Mockingcast. He and his family live in Charlottesville, Virginia, where he also serves on the staff of Christ Episcopal Church. And David, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Al. I appreciate it.
Let's take the title of the book, Seculosity. I don't think I've heard that word before.
Well, that's right. It was definitely something I put together. It's simply a combination of the word secular and religiosity, sort of a mashup in the way that people do today. But I wanted a word that could describe what, as someone who'd grown up in the church and going to church, I was starting to feel like all sorts of everyday activities were beginning to function that way or feel that way, but maybe not without some of the positive things that church brought to my life.
Sure.
And so seculosity is really my shorthand for religious feeling or devotion that is aimed at at an earthly rather than a heavenly target.
Right. Right. You know, I've been surprised at seeing a number of books published in the last 10 years at least, where men who are well known as ideological atheists have had to start writing books about religion for atheists. And there seems to be a recognition, even among those who reject the idea of a transcendent God, that human beings do function best when they believe that there's some overarching transcendent reality, or they try to find a certain at-oneness with the world around them. Is there a religious impulse here that even atheists have to recognize?
I would say absolutely. Really, when you say someone is religious, it really is, the question is just how they're religious, not whether they are religious.
Right, exactly.
And that depends on how you define religion. Are you just talking about, you know, the big three, you know, Judaism and Christianity and Islam? Or are you talking about simply the overarching cosmology that someone has, or the values that they hold? And in fact, I talk about religion as sort of your preferred guilt management system.
Okay.
We're all walking around just because we're human beings and we're stepping on each other's toes, and there's a degree of guilt and shame that comes along with being a human being, and what you do with that tends to be to function for you like a religion, a place where you're not only getting community and ritual and transcendence, but also maybe absolution, or a place where you're going for enoughness.
Sure.
Righteousness is the real word for it.
So are we looking at here, you talk about career, parenting, technology, food, politics, and romance. Using the old language, are these things becoming idols?
Well, I think they absolutely are. I mean, if the more, I think the older I live, or the longer I live, the older I get, the more you realize that idolatry can describe a lot of things. It really kind of, if you drill down into it. My aim with the book, though, because that can be kind of a vague or almost off-putting word.
Sure.
I wanted to talk less about worship and more about self-justification.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that people are leaning on their diet or their parenting or their voting to give them a sense of righteousness, so sort of make them feel like their life is valuable, justified, in a way that I think is very similar to idolatry, and there's no like line in the sand at all. But I don't think we're worshiping, the voting booth per se.
Right.
I think we're we're not worshiping our children. We're worshiping the sense of righteousness that we receive when our children, you know, get all sorts of accolades or other parents treat us as though we are authorities in some way.
You talk about performancism. Tie that in here.
Well, performancism is kind of another kind of made-up word for the sense that there's no, or the notion that there's no distinction between what you do or your resume and your identity, yourself.
Okay.
There's no distinction between how good you are at something and your own essence, I guess. So the school you went to, the person you married, they're not just descriptive of you, they are you. And that can lead to, you know, that can lead to parents paying $500,000 to get their kids into the school that, through the back door. Because it's not just education that's at stake, it's identity that's at stake. So performancism is simply that there's no distinction. Because performance is a big part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's no distinction, no sense, oh, I'm a child of God, as well as a father and a, you know, a friend and a brother, you know, a coworker, when there's no distinction between my accomplishments and myself, you get into some very ruthless and confusing waters, I think.
What we desire has much to do with who we understand ourselves to be, and it seems to me that a disciple of Jesus is more engaged in the hungering and thirsting after the kingdom, righteousness, than he is even about knowing or believing. What's the relationship between what we desire and what we perform?
Well, I think that they're deeply related because, the affectation or the orientation of a person's heart really does, what is, you know, where your heart is, there your treasure, or where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. That's, you know, the words of Christ, and they're 100% true. So the desire tends to be, and whether or not it's just completely inborn or a nature of the fallout of sin or something that's inculcated by society, but our desire seems to be for other people to tell us we're enough and that we are good, that we are valuable, and that ends up being a desire that's deeply self-oriented rather than other-oriented. And I think of people who follow Jesus, that there's really a sense in which you lose your life to save it, that you become of use to other people, and that's where you actually your desires tend to almost be extinguished, but met in an almost paradoxical way. And so we always talk about the importance of service, not necessarily because other people are dying for you to help them, though they are, but mainly because that's the way path towards healing and God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You talk about the seculosity of romance and the myth of the soulmate or the myth of the twin flame. Or there's all kinds of words that are used to imply that there's this one right person among the entire population of the earth, that if we find ourselves matched up with this one person, somehow we will have attained a kind of a romantic, the romantic equivalent of heaven on earth.
Mm. I mean, that is, I think, what almost like the gospel according to Hollywood. And it's not to deny that romance is thrilling and can be quite transcendent.
Sure.
But this idea, when you really get down to what people are looking for in a spouse today, it's not just to be their best friend and their the co-parent and their person who provides for them. You get to and fulfills their every emotional need and almost anticipates it. That sounds more like a savior to me than an actual person to kind of go through life with and learn to love. And I think that creates a lot of anxiety around dating and finding the right person, as if only one person out there can do that, or you can only be that person to one person. So,
yes. It puts an extraordinary burden on your spouse.
My goodness.
You know, if your spouse is kind of the one who relationship reflects back to you, whether things are all right or not, they can't meet. No human being can meet that those deepest needs that we have for God. And I think Christians, as they've, you know, idealized the family, they oftentimes, I think, do believe that when I get the right match, as Adam had Eve, when I get the right match, kind of, I've got the future laid out for me. Things are going to be fine.
Oh, I know. Well, I mean, what's the great phrase from that movie Jerry Maguire from, you know, the 90s, which was, "You complete me."
Yes, that's right.
That's a tall order for my wife.
Yes.
But more importantly, I don't want to be the one to have to complete her because I know what I'm like.
Right.
And
right.
Maybe we can journey together towards God and other people, but gosh, heaven forbid that I would have to be completing her, because she would be really in bad shape.
Are we? I'm just wondering if this is a more of a problem for people of this generation than it was, let's say, two generations ago.
Well, I think when it comes to romance, it was a lot easier to choose someone, a good enough mate, when it was, you know, you're choosing between the people in your apartment building or your block, your city block, or your church, rather than a million and billions of people online.
Right.
I think that there is something that is paralyzing, genuinely paralyzing about that. I also think that the human desire for completion and for the enoughness and to be loved, that, of course, is just universal and timeless.
David, hold it there if you will. We'll take a break, come back. My guest, David Zoll, is author of a most engaging book called Seculosity: How Career, Parenting, Technology, Food, Politics, and Romance Became Our New Religion and What to Do About It. I'm Al Cresta. Be right back. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, David Zoll. He is author of Seculosity: How Career, Parenting, Technology, Food, Politics, and Romance Became Our New Religion and What to Do About It. David, do any one of these kind of dominate a more enthralling replacement religion than the others?
That's an interesting question. I think romance is usually the first one we go to.
Yeah.
But today, if you were just to take a look around, I think you could see that careerism or the seculosity of work is a very, very strong, and it's kind of the ultimate arbiter of purpose and righteousness and even sort of salvation for young people especially. And I think that then the seculosity of politics, I think politics is, we all note that the tribalism and the cult-likeness that you get, that you're starting to get by people not talking to each other. And I'd say those are very pronounced. But everything, you know, I talk about food being a kind of a replacement religion for folks, and wellness is a big one. Parenting for it, but that sort of applies to a life stage, and it's a little less broad. But anyone who's a young parent today knows that they're just bombarded by heresies,
yeah,
and condemnation that feels like you're in a church with no mercy.
Has something broken down on our understanding of the Christian faith that makes us more vulnerable to these replacement religions?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the liturgical churches, like the Roman Catholic Church my church, we at least have the liturgy to kind of stick to, which is wonderful. I think that popular religion, or the kind of mainstream, I call it Jesus land in the book,
yeah,
I think it has been a little co-opted by the spirit of self-fulfillment. And especially, church becomes another place to assert your righteousness or your enoughness rather than the place you go to receive it. Or as someone said, is church the place you run to when you've messed up, or is it the place you run from?
Huh.
And, we have sacraments like confession and absolution,
right,
and all these things. You know, without that release valve, you know, I think the clergy really historically, for all of our, you know, the problems and
sure,
we can all list that, they have really been, a friend of mine referred to them as your local forgiveness person.
Yeah. No, that's good.
And what would it be like I think it's certain, you catch glimpses of it for sure, but by and large, the church has a mammoth, the church, you know, universal has a mammoth PR problem.
Yeah, this is, I mean, and it's hard to know what changes that, right? I mean, within Catholicism, for instance, at the close of the millennium, the public face of the Catholic Church globally was Mother Teresa and John Paul II. You know, right now, we run the risk of it being a dirty old man in a Roman collar. Perceived moral authority on the part of church leaders is part of the problem here. I guess, of course, the answer is always to produce saints, towering figures that are embodiments of love and forgiveness and charity towards all. Is there any way short of that that the churches can regain moral authority?
Well, that, the climb back up to moral authority is going to be a very long one, but
yeah,
with God, anything is possible.
Like, yeah.
I want to say that our hope really is in God,
right,
and that God has not abandoned his church, and there have been moments, you know, periods of terrible, apostasy in the past,
yep,
and we're not without resource here. The Holy Spirit, you know, the church has been through rough times before, which is important for people to know. I think that with the way that technology works today, frankly, things can change very quickly.
Yeah.
For good and for bad. And I don't know. I have hope. I think that the things like with the Mass, there's pauses, there's silence, it's so countercultural when you
right,
really get down to it, and people are so harried and distracted, and they're really afflicted by that. I think a lot of people feel powerless to absent themselves from some of these patterns, but I believe that the church is only going to get more countercultural, I think that's actually a good thing. The embodiment of it, you know, that you actually show up and you're sitting next to a human being, you're not online.
Right, yeah.
I think these are great things, and so I have deep hope, but my hope is in God, not in the systems that seem to have been co-opted by seculosity.
You know, it is interesting, isn't it, that at Mass, at liturgy, there are these times of silence and pause, and you're with a group of people doing it. I mean, I'm trying to think, where else do we do that? Maybe at a classical music concert, you expect some quiet in between movements or something. But generally, when you've got a group of people together, somebody's usually poking us to get us to feel something, you know, to shout, to make noise.
Manipulate, yeah.
Yeah. That's
no, and in the Mass, you're not only silent for the purpose of being silent, you're there to receive.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
You come with open hands, and it's and to confess and to, you know, to hear again and receive the body and blood. So I think again, the way that seculosity works is it seems to promise people peace, but it delivers more anxiety and more demand. It's merciless. There's no mechanism for any kind of second chance or forgiveness.
Right.
So as someone told me, the internet is just like the real world, but with all the forgiveness vacuumed out of it.
Yeah.
Church can be that.
Do you believe that, politics is, again, an area that traditionally can work as an ersatz, quasi-religion of sorts, and And in some ways, our politics have taken on the tenor and have the polarizing dimension of a religious war. And I think perhaps that's because for us, for many Americans, politics is the ultimate thing. It is the way you identify with a particular community. It's the way you identify with a particular view of the way the world is going. It's where you identify with what it means to be a good person.
I think you have politics has become an avenue for belonging.
Yeah.
In a way that I'm not sure it always was. I remember you read studies about how, people used to be totally fine with their child marrying across the aisle,
right?
But not with marrying a different, religion. And
right.
Today, they're fine with you marrying a different religion, but heaven forbid you marry someone on the other political side. And that just goes to show you. I think sometimes people's politics leads their faith rather than their faith leads their politics.
Right. Right.
But I believe, I think the gospel and the New Testament and the church at its best has done all it can to break down barriers and say we're all children of God, but we're also all sinners and we're all in need of forgiveness. And right now we have an us versus them mentality
mm-hmm.
that is not really something you can find in the magisterium or in the,
right.
in the great documents or thinkers of the church or even in Christ himself.
Yeah,
he just seemed to oppose self-righteousness, which has kind of become the that's underlying the performancism.
Yes,
that we're I'm better than the guy next door. That's the most important thing for me to be.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I think this your idea, your focus on performancism is really good because I do think most people feel as though they must do something in order to be valuable. And that includes even performance before God, as though somehow we can justify ourselves or somehow we can obligate God to give us so many units of grace because we've generated so many units of faith or works.
That is very, very true. I wish it weren't the case that the human spirit does that, but we want to be in control, basically,
yeah.
And so we want to be the one telling God how much we deserve, and we really have a hard time, with receiving. And yet, that's also where the hope lies. And when people come to the end of themselves, when they really get in trouble, and they don't really have much to bring to the table except for open hands, I believe that's where we run into something like grace.
I guess, do you believe, as you you look over the Christian landscape of America, do you think we're at a moment where grace is becoming a more active force, a more plausible way of understanding our place in this world?
I think yes, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think as various forms of parenting, career, technology, all these things I talk about in the book, as they become more and more merciless and the treadmill gets faster
yep.
and faster, you can only go so fast. And we're a creature, not a creator. And really, so eventually the wheels fall off the bus and more and more people seem to be coming to recognize that something about this modern life that we're living isn't really working. And what do we do with the fact that we don't seem to be perfectible in
right.
the way that we that maybe Madison Avenue promises. So I do see I see it becoming a premium. I just pray and hope that Christians around the world can really trumpet that message that God is the God of the God of revealed in Jesus Christ
mm-hmm.
is the God who forgives
yeah.
and who actually loves not perfect not the righteous but sinners. And is there to to meet you, and is not another place. I think again when church becomes another place where you feel you have to be good enough, rather than the place you go when you've proved that you're not.
That you're not. That's good.
I think that is, and that's baked into our faith from its founder through its scriptures, through its early church fathers, through you know, in almost every of his expressions, if you really get down to what this is about, and you, you're going to run into that that animating idea and that animating truth, I would say.
Over the years, I've done a fair amount of personal evangelism, and I actually pastored a church for a while, and I can't tell you how many people told me that they'd begin returning to Sunday worship when they after they got their life together. But that's a perfect entree to present the gospel, show them a different way. Great talking with you, and I hope we can talk again.
Thank you, Al. I so appreciate it. Great talking with you.
David Zoll, Seculosity is the name of the book. I'm Al Christo.